One Freemason greets another, and he's not sure if he's really a Freemason. He'll ask him if he's a traveler, or if he's traveling, or if he is a fellow traveler. Would they meet? And this exchange takes place. The one being queried, if he is indeed a member of the mystery religion, will say, yes, I'm a traveler. To which the first, or the inquirer, will respond with, where are you going, or where are you traveling? From where to where? And the answer will be from west to east. For the east is the position of the rising sun, where the knowledge comes from.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. If you're a Daily Mail reader, you're probably thinking Bristol's the easiest place in the country to get a job as a paedophile teacher. Tynings Primary School in Staple Hill right the way up to the elite Clifton College public school. Schools are looking the other way when presented with evidence of pervert teachers, and as they prepare for the new academic year, flouting the government's so-called admission rules, some of them. Plus, Turkey and the US formally moving troops into Syria. Tanks, artillery. Does this mean NATO are finally invading Syria? Are they allowed to do that without either going to their own elected MPs and officials or the United Nations? And why do so many people seem attracted to ISIS? Is there something in the Quran that tells them this might be a good idea? Are the Western military secretly using that to make sure they have an excuse to intervene in Syria? And the old chestnut of whether Hitler survived World War II. Do you think he did or not? A new angle on it this week as we look at the fraud trial surrounding the film version of a book, Grey Wolf. Why would a hedge fund manager put up the money for a dodgy docudrama film about Hitler's so-called life after the war? Our sister show Dialects, back at noon every Tuesday. This week we hear from two survivors of child sex abuse, and they've come together because when they tried to report their abuse as children, they discovered they were both sectioned and locked up by mental health professionals in the same hospital. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. But first I'm joined by Christine Townsend, former teacher. Hi, Christine. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Now, it's a bit of a dramatic way to introduce it at the top of the hour, this whole thing of both the elite Clifton College and Tynings Primary School in Staple Hill. Over the last couple of weeks, if you've been reading the Mail, it looks like Bristol has a serious problem with actually keeping its children safe from its teachers.
Well, what I would say, actually, in defence of Bristol, is Clifton College is an independent school. It's fee-paying, £30,000 a year. So it's not within the state sector. And the Twinings Primary School is under South Gloucestershire's kind of remit. So neither of these schools are actually directly related to what is going on in Bristol Local Authority. However, Bristol Safeguarding Board and the local authority do have a responsibility to safeguard every child that is in Bristol.
That doesn't seem to be working, does it? Particularly in Clifton. I mean, you know, that is part of their responsibility.
Well, I mean, the Clifton College case that came to light in August 2014 with this guy, Jonathan Thompson Glover. I mean, I've read there's been a serious kind of safeguarding review of this case. And it's up there with some of the with the national stories around institutionalised and systematic missing of sort of people that are not suitable to work with children and kind of governance failure that have been going on in these institutions and continue to kind of come to the attention through the media.
Okay, just reading from some of the press reports, this one from the Daily Mail, Rebecca Taylor for Mail Online. Our married Thompson Glover was not arrested until 2014, more than a decade after the first reports were made about his worrying behaviour. Now, that in itself is pretty shocking, if there are reports trickling out over a whole decade and nothing's done, Christine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this the report that I've read, it looks at specific incidents that were reported from parents over time, but it also looks at kind of more kind of uncomfortable situations that maybe some staff felt and reported, but also it looks at the culture of the school, and it's a kind of it's all of those things coming together, really. And it's systematic, and it's from the governance right the way down.
About 80 current and former staff were interviewed in a special report by Penny Jones. Former head teachers Andrew Hugh Munro, Stephen Spur and Mark Moore were called to give evidence. The report was released on Monday, the 15th of August, said the pervert started filming in 1998 when he put a camcorder in a bag in the shower changing rooms. It revealed in 1999 or 2000, boys at the college saw sixth formers tying Thompson Glover to a chair when a parent complained her concerns were dismissed by the school. In summer 1999, a cleaner and a young student reported he was found taped to a chair at the college whilst half naked. A few months later, he was found taped to a chair on the cricket square in just his underwear by a teacher who told head teacher Mr. Munro something. Told head teacher Mr. Munro. Munro denies this. In September 2000, then head teacher Mr. Spur launched an inquiry after reports that Thompson Glover was again tied to a chair as a prank, but told him whatever happens, don't do it again. Well, that was his ticking off. A cleaner also reported one of the boys was wrapped up in cling film by Thompson Glover in 2005. This also included virtually zero, well, very poor record keeping, and also Thompson Glover was having little trips away with the pupils outside school. So certainly again and again and again there were indications that something untoward was going on here, and yet it seems Clifton College were just treating each incident as if it was an isolated incident on its own and not joining the dots. Is that credible, that they could actually fail to join the dots?
Well, that was found that, as you said, and as was correctly reported in the media, this investigation demonstrates that the records records just weren't kept. They either weren't kept, they were incomplete, or they were lost.
And so surely, if anyone has there's some sort of problem with somebody at work, surely at the very least something would go into their personnel file about it, you know, some record of an incident, particularly when it's, you know, involving these young kids.
Well, that clearly didn't happen for this particular incident, and what's not clear from the report is whether other staff members, you know, were other personnel files kept up to date? Were they okay? We don't know, because that's not what that was with outside of the remit of this report. So, you know, the fact that Thompson Glover was caught and that the college now has put in, you know, they've had to massively change their practice. But were there other staff that were also unsuitable to work with children that were operating in that culture? It would be perfectly possible, if the way in which Thompson Glover was treated by his line manager and his head teacher was the way in which all of the staff were treated.
Well, you get the impression, don't you, at Clifton College, they're thinking, well, because we're a private school, actually, we don't need to have any kind of rules. That seems to have been what was happening. And as part of this report, matrons, students and parents described how Thompson Glover showed most interest in year groups with a cohort of good-looking, naughty, sporty boys, in inverted commas. The report said favourite boys were singled out for beer, pizza and computer games at the teacher's own home. In 1998, parents told Mr. Munro, the head teacher at the time, about unsuitable rewards which had been handed out by Thompson Glover, who also swore at pupils, but parents said the head teacher wasn't interested.
Yeah, so this sort of behaviour is the behaviour that should have, the alarm bell should have been ringing. Favouritism is not something that is something that you would want in a school. The idea is that teachers treat all children the same. And the reason that favouritism is not something that you want to be seeing in a school is exactly because that's how you begin to groom children. That's how you begin to build their trust, make them feel like they're a little bit special, they're a little bit different. And you enable the children to have their own boundaries broken down. and it's really, really dangerous. And every member of staff needs to make sure that they're treating all children the same, because it might not be them, but it might be somebody else that they meet in their lives that then treats them like that, that do want to cause them harm.
Well, there's also another pattern here in this whole business, and that is where parents, in the report, they say that they took their concerns directly to the head teachers, but then the head teachers deny it. So it's just one person's word against another. The head teachers consistently say, oh no, these parents never came and spoke to us. In one case, in 2006 or 2007, an educational psychologist was told favourites were taken down to Cornwall, these same favourites, I imagine. He said that Thompson Glover had fitted the profile of an abuser. He and other teachers mentioned this to the head teacher, Mr. Spurs' successor, Mr. Moore, who simply responded, that's fine, something that he now denies. So this is all just about, a lot of it anyway, is to do with headmasters who just deny any kind of contact with parents who say they've complained directly to him.
Yes, and the complaints procedures and the way that in which the governing body, or the council as it's called, because it's Clifton College, handled complaints is one of the areas that's picked up, that they were dismissing complaints from parents and they weren't really taking them as seriously as that, and they didn't recognise how serious the complaints were. And it, for me, it's that recognition that they didn't have the awareness around safeguarding and how it is that individuals that want to get close to children so that they can abuse them behave in order to get themselves in that position.
Yes. Also, it's a bit like, I think, some schools, that the way they deal with bullying, because no school wants to have a reputation of bullying. It simply means that parents don't send their children there, and then their income dries up. And so some schools are in denial about bullying. It seems that maybe that there's a parallel here, Christine, where the Clifton College particularly was simply in denial about this entire problem because it didn't want any kind of news to get out about what was going on with Thompson Glover.
Well, yeah, so you've got that attitude absolutely at an institutional level, but what you've also got on a kind of personal level is people, because those that want to abuse will abuse others around them. It's not just about the children in themselves that they groom. They groom the staff around them, they groom their parents, and this is exactly what Thompson Glover did. So that actually, when you as a professional, as a head teacher, are faced with these kinds of complaints, what that then says, if you then go ahead with those complaints, is you got it wrong. And there's ego that comes into that as well. So there's all sorts of kind of personal, professional and egotistical things that challenges in that what they would have challenged in that head teacher. Now, I've never met this head teacher. I've got no idea if that's the case. But I have had one experience in my own professional life where a member of staff just disappeared and didn't come back. And the staff I worked with either didn't believe it or they didn't want to talk about it because they themselves felt that they were completely let down and they didn't professionally know how to handle it because it was someone that they knew and trusted and they themselves had been groomed. And these people are very very manipulative and they're very successful.
Thompson Glover was jailed for 3 years and 9 months last August, that's a year ago, after he confessed to 36 charges of making, taking and possessing indecent images of children. By the nature of these sorts of crimes, Christine, quite often after there's some publicity around a case like this, more children come forward and more evidence comes forward. And in fact, the court heard he hid cameras at different places around the school and was found with 2,500 hours of video and 1,400 indecent images on 330 tapes. So this has been something that had been building up over 10 years. But I mean, there is also, I suppose, another side to this, and where we've had some sort of justice with him going to jail. But what about some questions over whether the people who are running Clifton College, the council, are actually competent to do their job? Is there a case for possibly punishing them for just letting this happen for 10 years?
Clifton College, when this happened, Clifton College were in a position where they had to do a root and branch kind of review of what was going on. And what we see is a number of people at senior levels leaving. So the head teacher, Mark someone? I think it was Mark Moore. So this guy was arrested in August 2014. By Christmas, the head teacher had resigned and he'd gone. Now, I'm interested to know where that...
Yeah, Mark Moore is number three. Yeah.
So Mark Moore is like, where has that man gone? Where is that man now? Because he does have some serious professional kind of approaches that need to be challenged. And if he was running another a school somewhere else, I'd have serious complaints about that. Serious concerns about that as to whether professionally he was up to speed with where he needs to be if he was in that senior position. And the other person that I found very interesting that has since lost is a guy called Tim Ross. Now, you're going to know, Tony, who Tim Ross is. He's the current master of the Merchant Venturers. He was effectively the chair of governors, or they call it a council at Clifton College, between 2010 and 2014. Now, I don't know what month he left. But when he left, he went to sit on the governing body of Colston School, which, of course, is another one the Merchant Venturers are involved in. Now, whether he left before, during or after Thompson Glover was arrested, he left that same year. So, and Tim Ross is still involved with running schools in the city.
It's not even impossible that he left because he had wind that this was going to happen.
Of course, well, we don't know. So the question, but even if he left before... He was effectively the chair of governors at this at Clifton College for the last 4 years that this man was offending.
Well, there is a sort of mindset, isn't there, amongst the Merchant Venturers, which is sort of reflected by the way that this school's dealt with this problem with Jonathan Thompson Glover, and that is that they see themselves as sort of above everybody else, and in a way that is a parallel with the apparent lack of procedures at Clifton College. They're sort of, we are a privileged, entitled elite, and we will do what we want.
Well, yeah, that's certainly, in terms of safeguarding and in terms of internal procedures, that is absolutely the impression that I got when I read this report. I mean, I was amazed that every chair of governors, you have a clerk, you have a qualified clerk, then their role is to advise you on changes in governance issues and your legal responsibilities. And the head teacher sort of also advises you as a governing body around things that change within the education system. The clerk that Clifton College chose to employ had no educational safeguarding experience. So that's the level at which they're operating. Well, if you haven't got anyone, if you don't appoint anyone around you that has the expertise, then you're not going to know.
I'm going to have a wild guess. I'll say that their clerk was just one of their chums.
Well,
a wild guess there. Also, I mean, you know, whenever we, I mean, particularly since we've got the current master of the Merchant Venturers skipping sideways just before the proverbial hit the fan at Clifton College, I wonder if you could just remind us of the profile of the Merchant Venturers in our local, particularly in our local secondary schools. Of course, they are in primary schools too, because they seem to have taken a big advantage, in fact, being a part of the vanguard, in fact, in this whole business of academy schools and privatising education.
Very much so. I mean, the first academy school, secondary school, was across the road, the City Academy. John Laycock was the chair of governors right up until the end of the academic year that's just gone. And he's, of course, a merchant venturer. In 2008, City Academy, Merchants Academy, Colston Girls School and the Bristol Cathedral Choir School were all then part of something called the Southwest Academies Division, which was the Merchant Venturers run secondaries. Now, all of these four schools also have their own feeder primary schools. So they are a big player. They are second only to the Cabot Learning Federation in terms of who is running our state schools in the city.
So who are the Cabot Learning Federation? They sound a bit merchant venturey too.
Cabot Learning Federation was founded by David Carter, who is now the National Schools Commissioner. He was the regional one. He's now the national one. And they run Brunel, what was Speedwell, the Bristol Met. So they're in East Bristol, and the merchants are in sort of central Bristol and one in the south.
And what about primary schools? Because we don't often think of that. We think of the privatisation of schools as happening mostly in the big secondary schools. Mm. But it's happening in primaries too, isn't it?
Yep, so we've got the Cathedral Primary School, which is the nice feeder that feeds into Bristol Cathedral, the secondary school. Colston Girls Trust, they've got St Anne's Primary. They've got their new one, the Dolphin Primary School. They've taken over Bannerman Road, just up the road here. They've just taken over Barton Hill. because that was being run by a failed academy trust. Merchants Academy, they've got their own feeder primary, and they've just opened a specialist school for children with autism.
Well, why do you think the Merchant Venture is particularly interested in investing in schools, and what do you think they get out of it, or are they just being philanthropic?
Well, I'm sure they would claim that they were sharing their skills and their expertise in a philanthropic way. Schools aren't allowed to make profits, but what they are allowed to do and what they do is look around to who they're going to ask to provide their services for them. So it'd be interesting to see who provides the legal expertise, for example, or who it is that's doing the maintenance, or who it is that's doing the sort of the IT contracts for the schools. But it's about power,
about
influence.
At the Merchant Venturers, then they've got a whole bevy of corporate lawyers that might want to get in on the act there. Anyway, before we talk about admissions, must mention this that's been in the national news this week, which is peeping Tom headmaster, who called himself a sexual monster, is jailed for using a spy pen to film primary school kids and staff using the toilet. Ashley Yates hid a device to film young boys and girls as well as teachers. He was caught when his pen was found in a primary school in Staple Hill, Bristol, and he's jailed for 2 years, 8 months by Bristol Crown Court just last week. So I guess those two will both be coming out about the same time if they serve their full sentence. But anyway, this Yates, 45, Christine, was the head teacher, in fact, at the Tyning School in Staple Hill. The school pictured above, which they have in the newspaper, received an outstanding grade in its last Ofsted inspection, and yet there was the head teacher who people who had concerns about possibly about the way their children were being taught in the school or not taught would go to him. He was the boss.
This is an example really of how manipulative and expert those who want to abuse children actually are. That this man was able to hide what he was doing. He was able to manipulate people in order to believe that he had the best interests of the children, and that's why he was in the profession that he was in. Every profession is going to have people that wish to harm others, but when that profession is dealing with children and young people, there needs to be extra safeguarding and kind of vigilance around how individuals are behaving. And when it's a head teacher, that makes it quite difficult, actually, because everybody else that works in that school on a day-to-day basis is below them in the hierarchy, and it's quite it then becomes quite difficult. So there is a system whereby staff that may have concerns about a head teacher can go to the local authority. It's called the local authority designated officer, where anyone can go about a member of staff and have those conversations with them if they are concerned.
Yates, 45, as I said, was jailed for 2 years, 8 months after admitting 3 charges of making indecent photographs of children and 2 charges of voyeurism. Also admitted a further 4 counts of voyeurism and 2 counts of securing unauthorised access to computer material. Yates from Filton was caught with his spy pen at the Tynings Primary School in Staple Hill, Bristol. There is one other aspect to all of this, Christine. It could be that our local police are actually quite good at picking up on this stuff and they're not burying it like maybe other forces have done. I'm just wondering whether the fact that we've had both these cases over the last couple of weeks around Bristol, obviously South Gloucestershire, as you quite rightly pointed out, it's not actually quite Bristol, that maybe it shows the police are doing their job.
Well, the police will investigate if something is raised with them. So I don't know the story about that particular head teacher in that primary school, but clearly somebody found something and they then did the right thing. At Clifton College, however, it wasn't the police and it wasn't the school that found concerns about Thompson Glover. It was the National Crime Agency. So, and that was through CEOPS, which is the Child Exploitation and Online Protection, which is a national level service. So he was caught at a national level. It was nobody locally that caught Thompson Glover. I don't know about the head teacher, though.
It does what make you wonder, because I've come across this quite a few times where people go to the police with evidence about a possible abuser, and then that evidence is somehow not put together. So maybe 2 or 3 people have independently gone to the police, but at the end of the day, the police are not joining the dots sometimes.
Yeah, I'm sure that that still unfortunately probably happens. Systems have got better. They are getting better. But joining the dots is absolutely paramount if you're going to protect children and see it. Because you only hold a little piece of the jigsaw, but it might be that piece of the jigsaw that enables somebody that knows what they're looking at and understands the context in which people are working to dig a little bit deeper.
Well, before we go on to talk about admissions, I'm going to play you a little clip now from a piece which is going on our dialect show next Tuesday lunchtime. And earlier this week I spoke to Jenny Grace. She had electroconvulsive therapy at the age of 12, would you believe? She had been being sexually abused, she says, and then tried to report it. Instead, she was sectioned under the mental health system. This is in the context, of course, of the national VI paedophile inquiry, where we've had got now our fourth chair of that. The inquiry seems to be almost paralysed by a complete lack of leadership. Originally Fiona Wolf and Baroness Butler Schloss, both of whom had connections to those who had been covering up child sexual abuse. Then Lyle Goddard was brought over from New Zealand to chair the inquiry, and then she inexplicably, or without giving any kind of proper explanation, said, "I can't do this job." It's now being chaired by someone called Alexis Jay as of a couple of weeks ago. Now Alexis Jay chaired the Rotherham child sexual abuse inquiry, which basically didn't find any kind of there was no consequences for any of the police or any of the council officers or social workers that had failed to act on this abuse for something like 12 years up in Rotherham. So certainly the people I've spoken to who had been sexually abused have got no confidence whatever in this VI paedophile. But anyway, let's have a listen now, a quick clip from Jenny Grace as she described some of her experiences. As first of all, she'd been sexually abused as a child, and then she found herself actually sectioned and punished for trying to get the word out.
I was given ECT at the age of 12 years old, which is, you know, electrical. Nobody explained to me. I was sectioned on a ward. I was this is again St John's in Stone, taken down to the ward on this bed. I remember being wired up, looking at the nurses, begging them to tell me what was happening. Not a clue. And coming round, and it literally felt like my head had been sucked in, you know, like a balloon deflated. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're just, it's slowly, slowly arising. And you that in itself makes you feel like you're going to behave. And it's a lot to do with the children without a voice. There was a lot in where I was grew up, which was in Kingston Rispa, Buckinghamshire. There was a lot of children's homes, and you know we were ferried in a minibus back and forth. The children picked up from children's home and doped up either by drugs or drink to be sexually abused, and that was, you know, part of, you know, some of those drugs they gave us were very similar to the drugs we had in hospital.
Yeah, seems like certainly some complicity in their case between people in professionals in the mental health system and the abusers themselves. So anyway, you can hear the full interview there with Jenny Grace and Sam Hill, both who lived very close to each other and found out that they were taken to the same mental health hospital after they tried to report sexual abuse when they were children. You can hear that on next Tuesday at lunchtime, noon, in fact, next week. On Tuesday at noon on the Dialect Show. Christine, let's move on now to look at the admissions system, because we're just coming up to the beginning of the academic year, and as part of that, lots of people may not have got into the schools that they wanted to get, and there seems to be quite a lot of competition nowadays for the pupils who one might consider, in inverted commas, most able, particularly at age 11. So that it makes life a little bit easier for a big secondary school to get good results if they're cherry-picking kids who've already got good opportunities, maybe had a wealthy background or good educational background. Anyway, can you just lay out the picture of how the way admissions is supposed to work and how it actually does work here in Bristol?
Well, the law would say that it's supposed to be fair, that it's transparent, and that it doesn't disadvantage any individual or groups of children. The law does allow for faith selection. action. And it does allow for a number of other methods that academies can use within their admission system that basically creates barriers to certain groups of to certain children in the, from certain communities and certain individuals. And it, in Bristol, it's a combination of all of those things. It's not that all schools are testing children and they're banding them and then they're randomly allocating them, although some of them are doing that. We've also got faith schools. So we've got St. Mary Redcliffe that are, you've got to go to a Church of England school. We've got two Catholic schools, so you've got to be baptised if you're going to get into those schools. We've got Colston Girls School that have a 10% on how good you are at foreign languages. So it's the combination of all of these that make it utterly complicated, and each school has an idiosyncratic system.
Is that okay that they can do that? I mean, because you do have to have, if you're going to have a free school system, you have to have it certainly to a certain extent at schools where there are kind of specialisms, and you might wish to draw people from a very wide area in order to fulfil the wishes of their parents, because to a large extent it's the parents that are making these decisions, am I right, rather than the kids. At age 11, they're not really in a position to say, I want to go to that school, not that one.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, it's about satisfying parents, but particular types of parents, particularly from particular schools.
Are there any schools that you point to that are particularly bad at this, that are bending the law maybe a little bit more than they should?
Well, in the last 3 years in Bristol, there's been 10 investigations that, and all of them have found unlawful practice, and that involves 9 of our 20 secondary schools. So I think that demo, you know, St Bede's was published last week. I referred that just after the spring. And I've seen other schools that I've been looking at other schools, and it's like, okay, well, I'll refer that school next year, and that one needs to be referred as well, because...
Is it just you doing this? Anyone
well,
else?
It appears to me just
well,
to be
well
me.
Done.
Yeah.
All I can say, well done.
But the local authority does have a duty to be doing it, and they're just simply not doing it. And I don't think they've got the expertise. I don't think they want to challenge the schools.
Well, that's not very good, is it? Come on, get your finger out, Bristol City Council. Come on, Marvin.
Absolutely. Well, Marvin said during his election campaign that he wants fair and transparent admission arrangements.
But
well,
is he doing anything about it?
Well,
or is he too busy?
I've not seen him do anything. Nothing has happened, and nothing would have happened, to be fair, to Marvin for September 2016. But come September 2017, we should see a difference. And if we don't, it's because he has not got himself anybody around him that knows what they're doing when it comes to admissions.
That's funny, because we were hearing something along the same lines in the first hour from Charlie Bolton.
Well, that
you know, in that he's basically having to deal with George Ferguson's selection for all of his senior people, and so he needs to get them swapped around and get some people he trusts in place. Anyhow, just give us an idea of what you've found in the last few reports on admissions. On which schools were they on?
Okay, so the most recent one was St Bede. So this is a Catholic school. It's down in Lawrence Western, although it will serve very few children from Lawrence Western, because you've got to be baptised Catholic. You've got to go. There are certain schools, feeder Catholic schools, that they take from first. Plus, they take from the whole of the diocese. So,
but
we've got
surely,
about,
I mean, if
three
parent,
local authority
parent
areas
wants to get their children in there, they will say, okay, let's just go to Catholic church 1 week, and we'll.
No,
get
no, you've got to be baptised. It's not about going to the church. You've got to be you've got to physically go through the ceremony of being baptised into the Catholic faith.
Okay, so is that full immersion? I'm just wondering, you know, what do you have to actually do to get into this school? Have they got their own kind of baptism pool in the mission year or something? I mean, do you know what you have to actually? I mean, is it
well? The only thing I know about Catholic baptism is when you're a tiny baby and they go and put water on your head.
Well, that's christening.
But maybe that's christening. Church of England.
Well,
yeah,
no, that's christening. I mean, baptism is something that you do as a teenager, isn't it, Martin? Maybe we better bring you. I'm sure you know
something
about that.
To be baptised a Catholic, they go in for infant baptism, but of course, some Protestant denominations go for adult baptism, because that was one of the reasons why the Protestants broke away from the Catholic Church, because they didn't believe in the sacramental baptism shouldn't be administered to children. It should only be administered to those who are of a sufficient age to know what they're
doing. Is this
doing.
Appropriate a little bit of paper to have when you're trying to get into a school?
Well, an issue about whether any religious organisation should directly control a school, because they're not, using public funds for this. And of course, because of the what's changed in, we've now got Jewish schools, Islamic schools, etc.
You said Islamist there, didn't you?
No, I think I didn't. You better retract that. I said Islamic schools. Now, of course, there's no argument against having those. If you're going to have Catholic, I went to a Church of England primary school. If you're going to have Church of England schools and Catholic schools, and there's no reason why you shouldn't have any, but I would argue you shouldn't have any of those. All schools should be local schools in which all children go.
They should all be secular.
And in actual fact, I would argue, when I was a kid, it was the case that most people walked to the school which was nearest to them, which is what I did, and that's what used to happen.
I suppose,
of course,
that's the obvious
thing. The choice that's been created now is only feasible in a city like Bristol. Of course, in rural areas, it doesn't work at all.
I suppose that's the obvious thing Marty's pointed out there, Christine. Why can't people just go to their nearest school? Obviously, there's a certain amount of, you know, maybe selection over, you've done an exam at age 11 or however, you know, you may have to do an entrance exam for school. But isn't that the basic rule, the way it should be, or not? What do you think?
Well, I would largely agree, yeah. And but the reason that some local children can't go to their local schools is because of the ways in which the local school is choosing to allocate their places. It's the school, it's the institution of the school itself that needs to change, not necessarily the choices that parents make. So there has been, I think, a focus on trying to convince parents that, look, the school down the road, the good one down the road is a good school. And to some extent that may or may not work. But actually, once that school down the road, you know, might drop its GCSE results, there's certain parents in that area that have the know-how that can get them into some other school in the centre of Bristol or wherever, and that's where they choose to send them.
Well, fascinating. I just wonder if there's one particular school which is the worst. Is it Colston? I think we've talked about Colston Girls' School.
There's two. I would say there's two. Redland Green School has got a lot to answer. Now, Redland Green School does exactly what Martin just said. He said, oh, they take local children. And it's like, yeah, well, you take local children because you serve the elites of the city. Redland Green has got the lowest number of children entitled to free school meals, 4%. That school can prioritise kids on free school meals, but they choose not to do it. Now, that is a fault of the governing body in the school, and they need to start doing that because they need to start serving their fair share of kids that are grown up in Bristol. That's the first thing I would say. The second one I would suggest is St Mary Redcliffe, because St Mary Redcliffe, all my life, St Mary Redcliffe has put itself forward as this inclusive school. 7% of their kids are on free school meals. They take from outside of Bristol, and they take 16 children that live on that local estate, and yet they won't tell you that it's 16 out of 216. They'll just say, we take local children. But when you look and you go, it's 16%, it's 16 out of 216 children, you need to start taking more children than that, actually, and you need to stop talking about yourself being fair and being inclusive when 7% of your children are on free school meals and the city average is 25.
Okay, so come on, Redland and St Mary Redcliffe, sort it out.
There's a few others as well, mate.
Maybe next time. Anyway, Christine Townsend, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show again.
Okay, thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
United Nations admits it caused the Haiti cholera outbreak that killed 11,000 people after untreated sewage flowed into the river from the peacekeepers' base. Now, this is a throwback, Martin, way back to 2004, the Haiti earthquake. Something like 800,000 people got sick because of this cholera outbreak, and the UN caused it all. It's only 12 years later that they finally admitted it was our cholera. Sorry, guys.
Well, yes, and of course you might ask yourself the question, what are UN troops doing there anyway? And that's because the democratically elected government...
Well, they've been there ever since. They moved in at the time and they haven't gone away.
Yeah, but don't forget that when Jean Bertrand Aristide wanted to fly back from South Africa after the earthquake, the US Marines had already taken over the airport and they wouldn't let him return to the country. So in other words, Haiti has had an earthquake, but it's also been dominated by outside forces trying to prevent them having their own indigenous political development, and it's still going on. They're having elections, but they're ones in which the Lavalas movement that Aristide represented wasn't allowed to stand, and Aristide himself has been prevented from standing by US pressure. So the UN troops that are there, because they are troops, are there to keep the population under control, because the UN's been manipulated. So you've got to ask yourself, what are they doing there in the first place? And then, of course, the untreated sewage flows into the... And, of course, I think it was guys from Nepal, possibly Gurkhas, who were carrying the cholera.
Now,
This is just cherry on the cake of the horror of what's been going on in Haiti.
Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Only a quarter of Haitians have access to a toilet. Sewage is rarely treated, and safe water remains inaccessible to many. Well, it doesn't seem a lot has changed since the earthquake, in fact.
Well, it hasn't.
So what are all these people doing? Is this just an excuse for the US to have another kind of military
base? Well, you've got to remember that Haiti has, in fact, got massive oil reserves just off the coast of Port-au-Prince, the capital. And that's unfortunate for them.
Is it becoming, of course, another kind of client state, a bit like the Philippines? Well, I mean,
Aristide, if he'd been allowed to continue as the president, would have been in a position to do something pretty substantial for the poor people who voted for them with the oil that they've discovered. But of course, at that point, the power brokers in the world outside go, "Oh no, we're not having that." That would be a good example. So Haiti's democratic processes have been comprehensively sabotaged, and the earthquake just gave a tremendous opportunity for, you know, outside forces to move in to help, inverted commas, including the Clinton Foundation, which is at the centre of all these controversies in the US now. And of course, they're basically manipulating the situation for the benefit of the wealthy elite in Haiti itself and their backers elsewhere in the world.
Also this week, something announced called Operation Euphrates Shield. This is by the Turkish military. Marvellous graphic comes from the Turkish diplomatic service. I say marvellous, it's just chilling, really. The Turks doing artillery barrages. They've got a lot of their tanks now swarming in. Well, maybe that's a bit of a pejorative term, but the tanks moving down into Syria in Turkey, Martin. They have a whole bunch of talking points. A little card which is given to all of their politicians and diplomats, so they can excuse this in a nice easy fashion. Point number one is, why are you doing this? Why Euphrates Shield? Turkey has announced that the west of the Euphrates would be a red line. Turkey said it will consider any terrorist organization entering this area as a threat, so they have moved in.
Well, the Jarablus corridor, which they are have now seized, was the...
Let's just do the geography here. The west of the Euphrates is in a lot of Syria, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, what you've got is...
So they're saying any terrorists in the west of the Euphrates, we can go and get them?
No. What had happened is that the Kurdish forces were on both sides of the Jarablus corridor, which was, in theory, under the control of ISIS. Now, ISIS, as we know from what the Russians have been saying, has been backed by the Turks from the very beginning. Now, what's happening now is that the Kurds were pushing in from both sides to take over the corridor, which would then have cut off all of the supplies from Turkey going to Aleppo to the radicals that are fighting in East Aleppo. So the Turks have now moved over the border to prevent the Kurds from squeezing ISIS out. And it doesn't seem that ISIS fought back. They may have been told by their Turkish puppet masters to get out of the way.
So what you're saying effectively is the Turks have moved down into this corridor in order to stop the Kurds cutting off supplies to ISIS?
Yep. That's basically
absolutely bonkers, isn't it?
Well, it's not bonkers from their point of view, because they're trying to prevent a Kurdish state being established, and they want to keep the lines of communication open to Aleppo, so that, because of course, if the Syrian government is able to take Aleppo and the Jarablus corridor is closed, then we're on the last lap of the war. And of course, there are war mongers in the United States, Turkey, and elsewhere who do not want this war to end.
I mean, okay, because so this
if
means
it ends,
large
it means
numbers,
they will have lost.
This means larger numbers than previously. I mean, there were small numbers around the border area. Lots and lots of Turkish troops now in Syria. Is this okay?
Well, it's potentially dangerous, because also the Kurdish forces, they started attacking. Up to now, the Kurdish forces and the Syrian government forces have had a neutral relationship with each other. They don't work together directly, but they don't fight with each other. But last week, Because the US special forces are embedded with the Kurds, they started attacking the Damascus regime's forces. So, but that then was brought to an end because the Russians stepped in and mediated it out and said, look, you know, you two have got to stop fighting. But the Turks now have come over the border. There's no basis in international law for Turkey to come over that border any more than there is for Saudi Arabia to invade Yemen.
Martin, let me just read you what the Turkish military and the Turkish diplomatic service, the little talking point card they've given to all their diplomats and everybody. What is the reason for Operation Euphrates Shield? Well, it sounds a little bit like why, but anyway, they've got a different talking point here. Turkey is using its legitimate right, which always makes you feel like they don't have that right, really, but they've said their legitimate right to defend itself by going into Syria. For a long while, there are rocket and mortar attacks on Turkish territory from the Syrian border, terrorist bomb attacks against civilians at Atatürk Airport in Ankara, Elazig, Diyarbakir, Gaziantep, we heard about last week, which were the London girls were smuggled by the Canadian intelligence down there, the London schoolgirls, and Van, the rocket attack on the district of Karamis. So there's a whole list of these different attacks which are being launched from the north of Syria by ISIS, apparently, into Turkey. To protect the security of our people's lives and properties and to prevent border incursions, the Turkish armed forces have started this operation to occupy northern Syria. So this, I mean, this to me does seem like it's something that's happened without the sanction of the UN, Martin.
Well, yes, there's no UN basis for it at all. That's one of the issues here.
So Turkey, basically Syria is just up for grabs for anyone with the guns.
No, it's not up for. It's more complicated than that. The fact is that many of these attacks inside Turkey, say, for example, where ISIS is supposed to have fired mortars over the border, that's that we've got telephone intercepts where Erdogan is discussing exactly that. Why don't we get some people to fire some things over the border so that we can say, oh, we've got to go in over the border to stop these people firing stuff at us? They've been playing these kind of games all along, and everybody in Turkey, whatever side of the political spectrum they are on, knows that NATO intelligence services, the MIT, which is the Turkish intelligence services, MI6, CIA, the Qataris, the Saudis, they all play these false flag games. So they carry out an attack. The attack on the Kurdish militants, which restarted the war with the Kurds, that was blamed by all the Kurds on the Turkish military. So you've got to realise that it's a double game.
US threat to shoot down Syrian jets is a declaration of war, says one analyst. Pentagon spokesman Captain Jeff Davis claimed on Friday the US fighters attempted to intercept Syrian planes to protect American advisers, a term for US military often used for its special operation forces working with Kurdish forces after the Syrian government jets bombed the area. So the Americans are going to have a no-fly zone, it looks like, in Syria now.
Well, they can try, but the fact is that the Russian Air Force is already there, and it's not at all clear that NATO, Turkey, the US, the RAF, remember them? They're supposed to be involved as well. It's not clear if they try to take on the Russian Air Force that they're going to win. And in actual fact, the SAS were told to get out of a camp in the south of Syria 2 weeks ago, and they then ran over the border, and the Russians got into a dogfight potentially with the Americans over that camp. Now the fact is that we're on the cusp of a shooting war between the Russians and NATO.
So
we're nearly there.
In recent months, in the background to all of this, the Syrian army, backed by Russian air power, has been making major gains against al-Nusra and against ISIS, recapturing several strategic areas from their grip. Now, is this American threat to shoot down Syrian jets just a... I mean, also, this is not going through the UN. It doesn't seem to have been talked about at all in the US by US politicians. This is just the US military deciding for themselves, we're going to shoot down a few Syrian jets.
Well, that's right. And the SAS who are filmed inside Syria, there's no basis for them to be there at all. There's the international law is pretty clear. The Syrian government is the recognised government of Syria, and they have the right to decide who does and doesn't. I mean, basically what they've been saying is, if you want to cooperate with us in fighting ISIS, we're open to that, but you're not just to come in here and do what you want. And the Kurds have also condemned the intervention. So it's getting very complicated now, because it's more than a three-way fight.
We've got the Turks, we've got the Americans, we've got the British all inside Syria fighting away. Is this a NATO issue? invasion, is it now there?
Well, it's been a NATO invasion from the get-go, because most of the rebels who've been fighting inside Syria have been armed, trained and directed by Western intelligence services, including our very own MI6.
Well, in the background,
we started the war in Syria, as Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, pointed out on French television 2 or 3 years ago.
In the background to all of this, back at some stuffy meeting of big business people, US defence contractors tell investors a Russian threat is great for business. This is Lee Fang writing in The Intercept. Absolutely brilliant website. Almost everything fascinating worth reading on there. Escalating anti-Russian rhetoric in the US presidential campaign comes in the midst of a major push by military contractors to position Moscow as the potent enemy that must be countered, with a drastic increase in military spending by NATO countries. Weapon makers have told investors they're relying on tensions with Russia to fuel new business in the wake of Russia's annexation of Crimea, they call it, and modest increases in its military budget, in particular the arms industry, directly and through its arsenal of hired gun think tank experts and lobbyists, is actively pressuring NATO member nations to hike defence spending, to spend at least 2% of gross domestic product on defence. Retired Army General Richard Cody, Vice President of L3 Communications, the seventh largest US defence contractor, explained to shareholders that the industry was faced with a historic opportunity following the end of the Cold War.
Well, yes, and various retired British Army generals have been lending their tuppence halfpenny to this, you know, Russian threat thing. We need to spend
just
more
to compare
on,
the Russian spending
on weaponry.
The Russian spending on weapons is around about $85 billion. The US $609 billion, so nearly 10 times.
Yeah, well, the US spends more on the military than all the other countries in the world combined. But much more. But of course, a lot of what they buy is overpriced rubbish. And in actual fact, when it comes to fighting, they haven't won anything. They just haven't won anything.
Moving to
ever.
Yemen,
Grenada, UK, I suppose you could argue they won that.
UK approved £3.3 billion of arms sales to Saudi Arabia in the first year of the Yemen war. This was a July story. Jamie Merrill in the Middle East Eye, actually. Exports of smart bombs, combat aircraft parts were approved in the face of civilian deaths in international condemnation. Campaign against the arms trade analysis of government figures shows the total is at least £500 million more than previously thought. £3.3 billion. Well, it's lots of money we're making out of this war in Yemen, and that's mostly a war against civilians, hospitals and schools.
Yeah, but when we say we're making that money, BAE Systems and shareholders are making that money, many of whom will be non-British nationals.
You talking of BAE Systems, people may not realise this, but the vice chair of the BBC nowadays, the BBC Trust Sir Roger Carr, is also the boss of BAE Systems, funnily enough. So you won't see any documentaries being made by the BBC about the arms trade and how much money the government and BAE Systems are making killing kids over in Yemen. Sir Roger Carr says his belief that providing a big stick helps countries bring about peace, allows us to do this work in a proud and positive way rather than with a sense of shame. Matt Payton, writing in The Independent, Britain's biggest arms dealer, tells peace activists selling weapons encourages peace.
Well, we know this to be just rubbish, basically. It's not just that we're profiting from what's going on, we're actually encouraging violence because for geopolitical reasons as well as venal reasons. And ultimately, of course, I'm not a pacifist, and you're going to find British and US military personnel wandering around in these war zones, and we're supposed to cry if they get killed, and I'm afraid I'm not going to.
Well, coming up in a few months' time is quite an interesting conference that's just been announced in London, which is looking at the Muslim angle on eschatology, in other words, the end of the world. So they're looking at the Quran, and they're looking at what the Quran says, and doing a proper critical examination of it in the face of what Mohin Yassin, he's the director of Global Vision 2000, a Muslim think tank, what he believes is the Western military industrial complex's twisting of the Quran to their own end. So let's have a listen to Mohin now.
Global Vision's having an event in London on eschatology in the 21st century, interfaith comparative perspectives. I don't think we can look at this in isolation. You can say it's about people's voice for democracy against dictators backed by the Saudi Empire, backed by the Anglo-American Zionist Empire, and the bankers on top of that. However, in Islamic eschatology, Syria, Sham is referred to, Greater Syria, and Yemen. These are clear pointers of special events which will take place and are taking place relevant to the coming of the Mahdi, the Imam Mahdi, because the key dimension that's missing, especially in the Middle East, if not the Islamic world, is leadership. That is the significance of the Imam Mahdi and his leadership, including military, by the way. This is very relevant to your work in 9/11. As you know, we're talking about a big deceit, yeah? I think we shouldn't underestimate the military, what we refer to as the apex of the cartel, of the pyramid, but the military, industrial, security, intelligence complex are aware of Islamic history. Very aware. The last thing they want is the revival of the caliphate or of any shape, form. So I think they have intervened in this region, in the Middle East, which they know, which is also central to their global empire, you know, the petrodollar in particular. They are aware of Muslim eschatology. Those who pretend that they aren't aware haven't got a clue about the Western military, industrial, security, intelligence complex. And I think they are preparing, they have been preparing to subvert it. Indeed, in the Hadith literature, the prophetic sayings, which are codified, it mentions there will be two black flags in this time. It's that detailed. The people don't know that Muslims don't just have the Quran, but the recorded sayings of Muhammad. There's a whole science other than analogy and reason. In the eschatological literature, it mentions there will be two factions, black flags. Now, is it not interesting that in Afghanistan, for instance, you've got the Taliban? They got the black flag, yeah? And now you've got ISIS or Daesh, which is a NATO Zionist creation. They've got a black flag. And do you know something? They're fighting each other in places like Afghanistan. Now, this is reported in the Hadith literature. It might surprise you.
That's Moeen Yassin there, and his conference will be being held on Saturday the 3rd of December on Muslim eschatology. Just time finally, Martin, for this story about Hitler. Jailed millionaire fraudster in Hitler movie scam. A major disaster struck the controversial film Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, and its executive producer, millionaire financier Magnus Petersen, is jailed for 13 years for fraud. Now, what's going on with this film? I mean, a hedge fund guy just funding this film out of nowhere. What's the point?
Well, as you know, Tony, what we've been looking at for many years is the role of ex-Nazis in going to Argentina and under the aegis of NATO intelligence services. They put out a film like this a bit, which is basically to spoil that narrative.
Okay, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7 coming up in the next 2 hours. Hopefully back from Sudan is Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi and Kamal. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Charlie Bolton, leader of the Green Group. Thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show's links and archives. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable bank holiday weekend. Join us next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.